Superstition discourages us from thinking too much about things that are too bad. Let sleeping dogs lie, we say. Irrationally, but honestly, we resist considering harsh possibilities, partly out of the very human hope that if we do not mention them, they will not happen, or more dreamily, might not even exist. My parents' generation had this feeling about the word cancer. In fact, at some level, most of us construe our lives most days as if we were, in the words of a poet and former parishioner now gone on to glory, as if we were temporarily immortal. Religion, sadly and regularly, includes measures of superstition, idolatry, hypocrisy, pride, sloth, and falsehood. This is the reminder, the warning given us in the Protestant principle 500 years old, the necessary religious critique of religion. You may augment or even multiply this manner of superstitious avoidance with regard to sermons. Hope, encouragement, promise, these are our homiletical preferences both in listening and in speaking. A fellow Ohio Wesleyan alumnus and an eminent graduate of Boston University, recently honored here and rightly so, made that his single message until his death on Christmas Eve in 1995. There is something to be said of and for, about and with Norman Vincent Peale and his power of positive thinking. Furthermore, there is simply sometimes a matter of courtesy at work in our reluctance to name the elephant in the room. We much prefer someone else to do so. If we are forced, we will sometimes use the device, the locution, "John said that," so bracketing the offense in a quotation of some hopefully absent soul or other. We avoid, but life has a way of presenting itself anyway. The day I deposited our youngest child in his freshman dormitory, I met a fellow dad, a fellow depositeer. I soon learned that he was from my hometown, Syracuse, and that he had been there in our own return year's time in that city during the late 1980s, and that he had been a university administrator. Ignorant, I went ahead to ask, "So how was your time in our neighborhood?" If I could describe the pain in his eyes, which I cannot, I would not, for your sake and mine. "I was heavily involved in the recovery from Lockerbie," he said. That probably means little or nothing to you from this long distance. Even then, 2002, it took a half second for me to catch the subtext, to hear the unspoken. And when I caught up, I sorely regretted my courtesy, my prying inquisitiveness, overheated on a day of much emotion. For in 1988, in Lockerbie, Scotland, 200 Syracuse students and others were hurled to their painful, horrific deaths by Libyan terrorists. In retrospect, you can draw a straight line with some other dots along it from 1988 to 9/11. That Christmas, then Chancellor Eggers gave an interview in the Syracuse Herald Journal. I will never forget the tone of pathos, of loss, in his interview, nor will I forget his grief, nor will I forget his challenge. He was quoted as saying, "We look to the chapel, and nothing seems to come." And now that I am a dean of a chapel, his words ring ever louder, louder still. Mel Eggers was a great builder, a great leader, a great president, but he never really recovered from Lockerbie, in my view. How could he? Remembering Eggers' challenge, I have written today's sermon, today's interpretation of Luke 21, itself an ancient apocalypse. Today, apologies now made in advance for what is an awkward and difficult message. I want to speak a pastoral word about the fire next time. We have together the wisdom of the Bible, the presence of the Spirit, and the experience of pastoral imagination to go on. But for a word like this, we will also need your wisdom, your spirit, and your experience. So in advance, I ask your patience, forbearance, indulgence, and perhaps even forgiveness. This is a hard word both to speak and to hear. As a world community, as a nation, and particularly as Christian people within both world and national communities, we need furiously to work to prevent, and we need strongly to be prepared. We need to work to prevent, and we need to be prepared for the fire next time. I say this as someone who had to wait to hear if parishioners survived 9/11, who conducted services with thousands of people present in those days, whose parishioners were sent to discover the remains of the dead in New York City, who rode through the after effects of 9/11 in a congregation of many thousand who were by turns faithful, angry, patient, vengeful, patriotic, nationalist, Christian, and American. After the following Sunday service, as powerful an hour of worship as I can recall, a good friend nonetheless critically said, "Well, that was all right, but you should have ended with God bless America." 9/11 did not start the fire. I hope that 9/11 is its end. I pray so, I work so, I hope so, and I fervently desire that it may be so, that no other child shall have to hear that mom went to work and did not come home because of a fire of that kind. And may we spend every thoughtful moment, every creative hour, every generous impulse to beat back the flames of the fire next time. My prayer and my expectation is that there will be no fire next time, no other 9/11. Such is not God's will. Such is not our desire. Such is in nobody's interest. But I have parishioners, past, present, future. I'm baptizing babies, marrying young people, counseling the bereaved, working with the sick, teaching faith by precept and example, and burying the dead Friday by Friday. And I have a pastoral responsibility that anyone with a pastoral imagination will admit includes being prepared for the unforeseen future. Our apocalyptic gospel from Luke 21, a fading late first century prediction of the end of time, no longer occupies, 20 centuries later, the kind of literal centrality for Christian teaching which it did in the year 90. Even then, by Luke's time, apocalyptic was waning. The church, beginning with the church's formative influence on the New Testament, converted apocalyptic eschatology into ethical exhortation. Portents and predictions of wars and rumors of wars became, in the main, as they are today, words of caution and preparation and warning. Take heed, be prepared. And on that basis, this morning we shall interpret Luke 21. Plan for the worst, hope for the best, then do your most, leave all the rest. How many times have you heard me say that in 3 years? Yet how often have we truly preached the first line, plan for the worst? Not all tragedy befalls someone else. Not all inexplicable, hurtful, senseless accident happens to other families. Not all fire burns in the next town down the line. Into each life, a little rain must fall, and more than a little rain usually does. If every heart has secret sorrows, which every heart does, then every home harbors potential hurt, as every home does. More. Religious expression has its perils. That is the Protestant principle 500 years old. The best way to prepare for the fire next time is fire prevention. The best way to stop the fire is to keep it from starting. And we all have some responsibility here. You have responsibility. You have responsibility in your time and in your way to strive for the things that make for peace. You can make a difference. Let me just take two examples, speaking of religion, with regard to a crowded, small world in which Europe and some parts of North America accepted religion is furiously alive. That is not necessarily a good thing, but it is a fact. First, you need to know something about non-Christian religion, and you are in a good place to make a start. In 30 minutes, starting here at Marsh Chapel, you can visit active communities of most of the world's great religions on foot along Bay State Road. Right here, you can take a walk and learn something in 1/2 hour about Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, atheism, and we will include for humorous effect that great New England religious expression, baseball. A simple walk along Bay State Road and out onto the Fenway Park will show you Hinduism, Judaism, Catholicism, Islam, Protestantism, and in all, the search for common ground. Or you can read Houston Smith or read him again. Before you come back to church, push yourself to some further, better comprehension of the world, of the world's religions. They make a difference, not always for the good. Take heed. It is good form not to judge what you do not understand or know. Walk in different moccasins. You need not affirm, agree with, or accept any particulars from any of these traditions, but these are things that matter greatly to the vast majority of the world's population, which population looks, by the way, not like you. Second, for your own health and well-being, you need, for your own health, to find one counter-influence to the fire next time of your own considered selection and make a point of doing something. Help Iraqi refugees. Support housing for the world's poor. Fund a mission trip beyond the borders of this country. Travel for learning and serving. Spend some time in Women Without Borders discussion groups. As Christian people, you have nothing to defend and everything to share. Support here our own nascent, new this year, Marsh Chapel and Boston University Religious Life Interfaith Council. If nothing else, you can write a check. Prevention matters. Nonetheless, all the prevention in the world and for the world is not enough to interpret this gospel. It is not enough to prevent, as primary as that is. We also need to prepare. We may have another serious catastrophe somewhere in the country or somewhere around the globe. It is not a question of taking such a portent in stride, for there is no such stride and there is no such taking. Yet we can prepare ourselves spiritually for days we hope will never arrive. We can prepare by taking heed, facing facts, being ready. How? One starting point is a phrase from our president in 2002. We shall meet violence with patient justice. I never tire of repeating this quintessentially wise proverb. We shall meet violence with patient justice. You may dispute the living of it, even harshly judge various failures, both in patience and injustice in the past years. That, however, does not diminish the truth and the honest integrity of the desire and the insight, patient justice. We can learn to respond, not to react. We can learn to be responsible, not reactive. That is to seek patient justice. But to do so, we shall need deeper, truer preparation. One wonders what kind of training those civil disobedient youth had 50 years ago that kept them in check in the face of dogs, hoses, curses, and clubs. No training alone would ever be enough. There must reside deeper in the heart what Niebuhr called a spiritual discipline against resentment, and what we today might simply name as Jesus Christ and Him crucified. That is, we are going to need to learn the arts of disciplined endurance. At some low level, our collective psyche tells us this, for we are pushing toward it. Hence, in this neighborhood, the increase in jogging, running, cycling, in all forms of physical endurance. At some bone level, our bodies are telling us to be prepared for a long twilight struggle. Those of us who live in U.S. cities by choice have every reason to think soberly in these terms. We are potential targets. Radical Islamic fundamentalist terrorism and other forms of terrorism are actual historic realities which need to be tracked, contained, and defeated by international police and military work. Meanwhile, here we are. The fact that another so-called fire may break out or does break out does not change the lasting commitments we have to freedom, peace, justice, love. In fact, such portents serve to toughen and harden our commitments so named. As Luke remembered his apocalyptic inheritance, let us remember our religious inheritance in the voice of one who can encourage and admonish and advise us. I refer to Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel is a great encouragement to many of us. Each autumn at Boston University on three Monday evenings, our community sits to listen as he sits to teach. Biblical theology, historical criticism, religious insight, and pastoral guidance are annually, regularly, beautifully combined. I listened to his third lecture this fall from the balcony. Due to an earlier commitment, I had to arrive a little late and so went up to the balcony. In any case, by confession, I am a balcony sitter by nature. The lines are always better there, the sound is always clearer, and there is plenty of space. Wiesel this year concluded his reflections on the tragic history of the St. Louis, a moment of American moral failure which had mortal consequences, with some words of advice. Coming from someone so wise and from someone of his experience, these words bear weighted meaning. I noted them quickly and quote them fully, for they bear weighted meaning. They bear weighted meaning for us as we face an uncertain, unforeseeable, unforeseen, and perilous future, he said. Waiting in the face of crisis is a sin. Silence in a crisis is a sin too. When you are planning to give help, do so quickly. Act yourself, do things yourself. Do not depend on someone else to do it for you. Never give in to despair. Never give up on hope. Think higher, feel deeper. So we also read in the Gospel according to St. Luke, chapter 21, verse 25 and following. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares of this life, and that day come upon you suddenly like a snare. For it will come upon all who dwell upon the face of the earth. But watch at all times, praying that you may have the strength to escape all these things that take place, and so to stand before the Son of Man. Amen.